What is really going on, crypto savages? You are listening to the CoinSpice podcast with host C. Edward Kelso, editor-in-chief at CoinSpice.io, your home for spicy crypto things on the net.
One of the better writers in the space, in the sense that you don't just regurgitate the top stories and, you know, kind of rephrase them. You actually go and do what shockingly is known as journalism in the space. So first off, Lee, thank you very much for coming on the CoinSpice podcast. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Let's get into it a little bit. For those who may not know a little bit about your background, how you got into crypto, journalism, and maybe even a little bit about CoinDesk, can you kind of tell us a little bit about both?
Yeah. So CoinDesk, I would describe as the leading publication in the cryptocurrency space. We cover all things related to crypto and blockchain technology. For me personally, I'm a journalist. I got my first newspaper job when I was 16 years old, and I've been working in the industry ever since. I got into the crypto space in particular in 2017, early 2017, right before things got crazy, when an editor at Newsweek Media Group asked if I could help spearhead their fintech coverage with an acute focus on blockchain technology. I said yes, but because this was an entirely new topic for me, only if I was able to do some deep research in order to get a firm grasp on the subject and figure out how we should shape that coverage. They said yes, and that sounded like an opportunity to really dig in deep and learn something new. So that's how my tumble down the rabbit hole began.
Yeah, and I noticed that CoinDesk kind of does it all. So they will do, you know, the technical topics. They'll do the controversies, personalities, interviews. They even have their own conference, consensus, which is all the rage. It's really nice that they hire and have people like you on staff, because you come from, you know, a professional journalism background. And I think that makes all the difference, in the sense that you will get out there and, you know, find primary sources and really do the legwork that's involved in fact checking a story, putting both sides to it. And a lot of that, just, you know, basically we're a relatively new industry. The crypto journals and the crypto news sites really lack that. Do you find that as well, that there's a kind of I guess lack is the word I'm going to keep using here, a lack of like proper journalism in the actual space?
Yeah, definitely. And to be fair to the journalists, when I first entered this space, I basically had to relearn how to do my job. We're really used to relying on external experts in order to give a third-party opinion. And in the crypto space, there is no such thing. Everyone has a bias, and data usually comes directly from some of the companies that you're reporting on. So you have to really think about different ways to fact-check and different ways to cross-reference. And so I think the result of that is you have a lot of people who are very passionate about the technology but don't know basic fact-checking principles and don't know basic research principles. So the reporting in the space can be pretty low quality in some instances. I am very lucky that I work with a team. I think the people here at CoinDesk, for example, my coworker Nick, who covers regulatory, are just some of the best in the entire journalism industry I've ever worked with in my career. So I feel really lucky to be here.
And you guys are the go-to for, in many cases, you have been for years, the mainstream press that maybe wants to slum in our our community. They will seek out CoinDesk, and they will cite you guys. I've seen it many, many times. So again, CoinDesk is a great resource, and Lee's reporting is some of the best you're really going to read. Super compelling stuff, and she does it all. She touches all the different subjects. But today, and in this particular episode, I want to hit on, I think you've taken kind of an original approach, and it goes back to at least last year. And this is the Bitcoin Palestinian Bitcoin. I don't know if I want to enter in this quickly, but the sort of the terrorist idea of Bitcoin being used for not just speculators and Lambo dreamers, but people who may, you know, basically be locked out of what we would consider traditional finance. Can you go into a little bit about, because I think it was September of last year when it was your first sort of foray was published. How did you find the Palestinian subject in particular?
So I used to work in Jerusalem, and I've been covering Middle Eastern politics long before I was covering crypto.
Oh, wow.
And it became very clear to me as I learned more about Bitcoin that this was a very clear use case, that this was there was an obvious need in this region, that there were all kinds of pain points when it came to transacting and when it came to accessing basic internet services. So I went looking for it last year. It was pretty hard to find people, and it's still hard to find people that are really engaged with the technology. But last year, I just did some very, very basic coverage on the fact that there is a Bitcoin community on the ground. And then this year, I did a follow-up 1 year later where I went back and I tried to see, has the community grown? Has usage grown? And actually, usage has grown in a way that I would never have predicted. It's really continued to expand quite rapidly.
And, you know, we could spend hours and hours. I mean, there are literal libraries filled with the subject of Gaza and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and all the things that go on there. But for those who are in the crypto space who aren't familiar with sort of the broader strokes, can you kind of explain what Gaza is relative to, say, Israel and the Palestinian idea? I know that's a hell of a question, but...
Yeah, no worries. So there is no country at the moment, no nation state called Palestine. Palestine is a region. That's what it was called before the state of Israel was established almost 70 years ago. Now there are two Palestinian territories, two areas where the Palestinians who once lived in the entire region now occupy. And they're separated with Israel in the middle. The West Bank on one side, the side that's closer to Jordan, is ruled by a party called Fatah. They have much closer relations with Israel. People can leave and do business with Israelis and with other people in the region. They're considered the moderates, and there's actually less Bitcoin activity there, probably because they have more access to the outside world. Then there's Gaza. Gaza is, it's called the Gaza Strip. It's right along the Mediterranean Sea, mm-hmm. and it has almost 2 million people that live in Gaza. It's one of the most densely populated territories in the world. Unlike the West Bank, which is very difficult to get in and out of, but it's kind of possible. Gaza lives under a military blockade. You can still leave and come in, but it's really, really difficult. The average salary there, annual salary, is under $22,000 a year. Around 30% of the population live below the poverty line. There's a lot of restriction because of the military blockade in terms of the flow of goods and also people and experts. Into the Gaza Strip and out, both territories, both the West Bank and Gaza, do not have access to services like PayPal, although Israelis do. And because of that, I think Bitcoin has become a very useful tool for Gazans looking to transact with the outside world, and also to some degree to people in the West Bank that are looking to transact both with Gaza and with the outside world because they don't have PayPal. But we've certainly seen that need drive usage. We've seen the need drives usage because mm-hmm. when I would talk to people in the West Bank, you know, there are some people that know about it. There are some people that are involved, but much, much less. When I talk to people in Gaza over the past year in particular, they've had some banking issues. The popularity and awareness related to Bitcoin has really increased.
Inside of Gaza, they're actually dueling governance factions, parts of Gaza that want to either rule it, control it, or represent it. And one of those groups is Hamas, the other is the Palestinian Authority. Can you get into a little bit of that tension?
So Hamas is the ruling and governing party in Gaza. They are considered by both the Israeli government and the U.S. government as a terror group. There is definitely something to be said that they have a military faction that is at mm-hmm. war with the United States and receives funds through what we would consider to be illicit methods. However, I think it's really oversimplifying to only think of Hamas as a terror group, although they certainly do things that we would consider to be mm-hmm. Unethical or more in line with that style of ruling, because they also are the ones that are running the hospitals and the schools. They're the governing body there. Yes, there is a Palestinian Authority, and there are some disagreements about how it is to rule Palestine as a region, because remember, they have their brothers, Palestinians, over in the West Bank, and they see right. this all as one body. Like, they don't see two different countries. They see this as one country that's been split by Israel in the middle, and they're not happy about that split. So there's definitely tension, mm-hmm. yeah, but I wouldn't say that the Palestinian Authority is at this point in any position to actually govern.
But the tension I'm speaking of is that the West is maybe a little bit more inclined towards the Palestinian Authority, whereas as you said, Hamas has been effectively boxed out in terms of the financial world due to its being linked to terror by the West. So that poses some huge problems. And so as a reporter, one, cryptocurrency and Bitcoin, especially in the mainstream press in the West, is kind of synonymous with things like drugs and terror and everything else. And then you're going in and stepping into this gigantic conflict. You're on one sort of side of it. And is there a tendency to, when you're describing it, do you have to kind of be very careful in the words that you use? Because I noticed, you know, you just came out with it and you said, look, this is how they see the world. And that's real important for readers to understand sort of going in why they're doing what they're doing whenever you're writing about it. But when you sit down to actually write the piece, is there a governor in your mind that goes, okay, I got to be careful. I shouldn't say this, or maybe it's just too biased, or.
I always try and be careful, and I try and make sure that I'm being as accurate as I can while honoring the perspective of the people in the piece. And there was definitely conversations with some of the people in the piece about when it is I should use the word terrorism and when it is I should use the word terrorist. And there is even debate amongst Palestinians. There are certainly Palestinians who believe that Hamas is a terror group, but there are also people who voted for them. And so I try and do the best I can to be respectful of the fact that different people have different perspectives on this body, on this group. And yes, there's a faction of Hamas called the Qassam Brigade that does engage in military conflicts where it targets civilians. So that's generally what we define as terrorism. But I don't think that that's the brush by which we should paint the entire Gaza Strip, because the fact of the matter is that there are 2 million people living there. And I don't think that just referring to Gaza as a hotbed of terrorism is really accurately portraying the wide diversity of peoples that live there.
And it tends to make Palestinians a sort of one thing, like a monolithic thing that you can point at and say, okay, they're all this way. And then when you use the terror word, the T word, it carries with it this gigantic cognitive dissonance, because it as a reader, you probably maybe don't want to read it if you're sensitive to that idea. But in certain respects, like you were talking about, Hamas is more than just this entity. It actually is a governing body and governance, and it does all these other things. So for some people there, Hamas maybe, you know, I'm trying not to be too cliche, but sort of one person's terrorist is another person's government?
Freedom fighter is what some people call them.
Yeah, yeah.
We do have to remember that they're living under a military blockade, that they do experience rocket fire, for example, from the Israeli military. And just because one side is doing it in uniform and the other side is doing it with funding via Iran or something, it doesn't mean that the people who are experiencing it have any different experience of that danger. So that's not to say that I condone what Hamas is doing. I
Sure.
don't. But I am very aware that when I'm thinking about people who originally voted for Hamas, because they were elected at one point, it hasn't been a free election in quite some time, but at one point it was, they weren't doing it because they thought to themselves, oh, we love terrorism. They were doing it because they thought these people are helping protect us and run our schools and hospitals.
Yeah, and so here you are as a journalist trying to go in and ferret out, suss out a particular niche within that community. And it's important that you put these things in perspective, I think, because then the reader can kind of step away and go, okay, well, now I'm reading this as a Bitcoin piece rather than all the polemics, because they can get that elsewhere. And so what I like about it is you found Ahmed, it looks like Ismail, who was a financial analyst in Gaza. How did you, if you don't mind me asking, and you of course don't have to divulge anything, how do you find such people? Is it just your doggedness or contacts or the fact that you live there?
I mean, I've been reporting on this region for a really long time. I know where it is that I can go when I need to find people, and I wish there was some kind of secret formula that I could tell you works every time, but it doesn't really. Sometimes I'll go through people that I used to work with that I know. Sometimes I need to do research and find new people. And I'm also, when I'm not even reporting on a specific story like I was now, I'm often, when it comes to very, very difficult regions to report on, continually adding context throughout the year, just keeping in touch, making sure I know, if there's a researcher at Dowser University that is studying blockchain or something like that, and I just make sure that they know who I am and I know who they are, so that when a story comes up and I need an interview, I know who to ask.
Got it. So you kind of keep an active Rolodex then. And so you reach out to people like Ismail and some others, and are they instantly sort of distrustful of what they would, I guess I would consider you, a Western journalist, or does it take a little bit longer to earn their trust that you're not just going to go, yeah, I talked to this terrorist and he wants to blow everybody? I mean, can they, like how do you smooth that out?
There are certainly people who distrust me, and there's a lot of people who declined to be featured in this piece. But I will say that there are so few journalists who are actually trying to listen to Palestinians that most of the time the reaction I get is, thank God, let me tell you what it is that I'm seeing around me.
Wow. Yeah, and so it turns out what got me to kind of read you a little bit more closely than I had maybe in the past and pay a little bit more attention this time around, was the Nathaniel Popper piece that came out in the New York Times a couple weeks ago. And he basically, and the New York Times, cited CIA analysts, and they were saying that that brigade, the Qassam brigade, the sort of the military wing of Hamas, mm-hmm. Was, you know, getting more and more, you know, sophisticated. They're using Bitcoin more, they're appealing for it more, they're learning how to use addresses. And, you know, I don't want to cast aspersions on Popper and the New York Times necessarily, but it seemed to me just kind of a really non-nuanced, sort of your typical, let's scare mom and pop about Bitcoin hit piece. And then, let me stop right there. Did that prompt you to write your latest piece?
No, actually. Everything that Nathaniel Popper said is true. Hamas is actually fundraising now with Bitcoin more than it ever has before. And before Hamas started doing this, maybe ISIS was the leading terror group that was using Bitcoin. And what Hamas is doing now pretty much dwarfs anything that ISIS was doing before. This is the first time that we're seeing on a terror group, what is designated by the U.S. government to be a terror group, prioritizing Bitcoin as part of its financial strategies in terms of fundraising and purchases and salaries and things like this. This was something that I became aware of several months ago. And I remember telling my editor, I'm going to take several months to do this piece because I want to do it right. And I can't promise you when it is, I'll have that answer for you. So we were both aware. I think most journalists in the space, or anyone who's paying attention in particular to Bitcoin, was aware that this is a true fact, that it is a trend that is continuing to grow. But because I've worked in this region, I didn't want fear-mongering about Palestinian usage to create a domino effect in which the average people who are using it day-to-day would find that they were cut off of services, the very, very few services that are still accessible for them. So I wanted to make sure to see if there was anything else that I could show beyond what we do know, which is, I mean, if you Google Qassam Brigades right now, their website in English pops up with a tutorial on how to give you Bitcoin. There is not a lot of research that is required in order to know that they have started to prioritize Bitcoin.
And that's very sexy, right? So as someone who's kind of on the peripheral of the crypto news, I mean, that's extremely sexy to me. I can put it up there with a bunch of guys with scarred faces and shouting, and I can talk about terrorism, and that's a nice clickbaity. You, and I'm sorry if I stepped on you just about to say this, you actually go deeper than just the Hamas connection. It's actually sort of embedded in the headline that they slapped on your piece that's dated on the 22nd of this month. In Palestine, civilians are using Bitcoin more than Hamas. That seems to me kind of a sort of a direct answer to, and again, you've explained that, you know, you were working on this long before, it just kind of coincided, but a direct answer to the types of pieces where in journalism, a lot of the time it's what you choose to highlight, right? It's what you choose.
Yeah.
To-
when I saw Nathaniel Popper's piece, I decided that it was important for me to publish what it is I had gathered already as soon as possible. I still do plan to do more research in this area, and I still think that there's other aspects to be explored. But when I saw Nathaniel Popper's piece and the kind of traction that it was getting, I felt like I wanted to make sure that there was also a counter narrative. Although I have great respect for his work, and there is nothing wrong in what he reported, he just only reported things that we already knew, as opposed to bringing new information to the table.
That's an excellent way to put that, by the way, and extremely diplomatic too. But it's a great way to put it, because that's exactly right. So here's your piece, and it's a follow-up almost a year to the day, really, maybe just a few weeks from when mm-hmm. you had visited the subject back in 2018. What's different now? What's changed, and what you kind of hinted at it earlier, what really surprised you about the difference a year makes?
The volume, first off. I mean, the idea that I've had traders telling me that they're doing transactions that are worth $5 million in a month, that's insane. When I was talking to them last year, we're talking a few $100,000 a month. Very, very
tough. And to be clear, this is not Hamas you're talking about. These are just Gazans, right?
Yes, this is Gazans. This is regular, everyday Gazans. This is civilians. They don't have access to things like American stocks, for example. So if you want to be doing online investing, or you want to be storing your assets offshore, and I don't mean that in a capital flight way, I mean that in the way of you live in a war zone, you mm-hmm. might want to have something abroad that your family can also access. Bitcoin is a really useful tool for that. Another thing that was really interesting to me is the hunger for the information. So I talked to one teacher who's been teaching people at various tech companies and traders and people who are just interested in learning more about Bitcoin in general. And he talked about hundreds of students. And okay, fine. So 300 students is not changing the world. But certainly when I spoke with them last year, I was talking to maybe dozens of people. So in terms of 1 year, I don't think that there's another region that I can point to where I've seen that kind of explosive public interest. And I do think, ironically, that Hamas fundraising in Bitcoin played a huge role in that, because it became something that was on the news. It was something that people heard about in the street. And it's not because they were donating to Hamas or they were wanting to be involved with the fundraising related to that military wing. It was
classic
just because it became
Streisand
something,
effect, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like, the funny thing is that Hamas trying to raise funds from abroad using Bitcoin made it a topic of discussion in the street in Gaza. And then people were like, so if they're using this, why? Why is it that they're pivoting to try and fundraise in this way? Could I do the same for my kid who I want to send to college? So that actually was a byproduct of the thing that Nathaniel Popper highlighted.
Unbelievable. And it really is a fantastic piece. And you go into you talk about the teacher. How did you find, now I've just lost the name. Is it Al-Safadi?
I found all the people the same way, just the traditional methods of journalism okay. and keeping contact.
No worries. No worries. No worries at all. After I asked it, I was like, oh, maybe I shouldn't have asked that.
I will say that I'm very deeply moved by the people that spoke with me, and many people contributed to this piece who were not featured, and most of the people that are in the piece are anonymous. And it was very clear to me that because of the association with Hamas and with terrorism, people were scared to talk about Bitcoin, and they were not scared last year. That's a big difference as well. So there's more awareness, but there's a lot of fear that anytime you put your name online, you say you're Palestinian using Bitcoin, you're going to be associated with terror, and then you're going to be blacklisted. So the people who did speak with me, knowing that I'm a Western journalist and I had every intention of publishing about this subject, I think were incredibly brave. And I have a lot of respect for the way that they shared information to try and help their own community. And in some ways, putting their neck out a little bit.
Yeah, and it's just we take, especially I'm in the U.S. On the West Coast, and we just take all of this for granted. So it really is, you know, as far as CoinSpice is concerned, if you take the politics out of it, and you just look at the use case, this really is for us the sort of the quintessential real world example of the power of peer to peer permissionless digital cash. Like, It is for us the reason why this stuff is so important. And when someone is willing to talk to you, you just don't even think about it. Like, it you know, we deal with it too on our end when we ask people, say in Venezuela, or we did a piece on Hong Kongers protesting there and using Bitcoin Cash. And it was funny because, just being a dumb American, I started asking the guy his name, and he was like,
Yeah. And I'm like, I mean, yeah. There were definitely sources I spoke with in the States who told me they were afraid for their lives if I published their name. Yep. So those names obviously did not appear. But I have a lot of respect for the fact that if you feel that you were found out to be talking to a journalist in a piece that was not flattering to Hamas, although I wasn't particularly focusing on them, could put you in danger, and yet they still did share the information. They shared it to try and show the global Bitcoin community that here they are and they want to be engaged.
And is there, you know, speaking of that, you spoke of, and I think what you're kind of sort of calling back to now is what you call in the piece the Hamas effect. Is there a danger that, taking the U.S. point of view for just a second, sort of the official point of view, that like a petty warlord, petty sort of government, de facto ad hoc government, as the U.S. would see them, is going to clamp down on, in kind of a perverse way?
That's sort of a very serious risk. Yes. Yes, that is it. So you were talking about there being a small conflict within Gaza about who rules there. I would not describe it as a small conflict. If there's an election going on, people who oppose Hamas get shot in the knee. So there's not really necessarily free election and free press. If you don't toe the party line, you could be in very tangible danger. So yes, I do think that there is a concern in the Bitcoin community. Every time they go and they do these major transactions, they have to give police a lot of their personal information. And that information can be used against them if, for whatever reason, it's believed that those people helped Israel, or they did something against Hamas, or it could even be helping other Palestinians who's against Hamas. It doesn't have to be necessarily a Western person. There is definitely risk, serious risk, that the community there faces. And I think that's one of the reasons why they wanted so much to be known by the global Bitcoin community, because this is not a game. This is something that they care about very deeply, that they use as a tool in their lives. And it's not, we in the West take very much for granted that we're transacting in a system where we have rule of law to protect us if something were to go wrong. So before I came to crypto in general, my expertise was actually in Middle Eastern politics, and that included Islamic extremists. When I'm covering this issue, I'm not covering it only as a Bitcoiner. I'm covering it as a person who started researching digital recruiting efforts among terror groups back in 2009. In 2015, I focused on ISIS in particular, and including the way that they were using Bitcoin at the time. I've been focused on this particular issue for quite some time. I'm pretty familiar with the way that these networks and these communities work. And I can say with that experience that I'm genuinely not concerned about Bitcoin being used as a tool for terror financing any more than Telegram or the US dollar. Like any tool that is popular amongst their constituents and globally is something that people will use both illicitly and for lawful usage. It doesn't surprise me that Hamas is increasing its interest in Bitcoin, but I also don't think that that interest is in any way greater than the civilian interest. To the contrary, I think it's much smaller than the civilian interest.
And there's all these anecdotal stories of boats of cash being used. So just paper money and fiat in general is being, you know, trucked in here and there, which is, you know, 10 times more anonymous than Bitcoin, which, you know, is pseudo anonymous and is actually quite easy to track if you know what you're doing. So, I think you're dead on about that. And again, I appreciate your sobriety. I appreciate the fact that, you know, I love the purient stories too, that, you know, the decadence of my culture where we're being naughty. So we, you know, we dial up a cam girl and we throw her some tokens to see some booty. But these kind of stories that really get into the heart and soul of what Bitcoin is, I think are the stories that will last beyond, you know, kind of kitsch and schlock. And I think you're very much contributing to a raising of the dialogue. And kind of on a last point here, I guess sort of know the answer to the question, but I'll ask it anyway. Do you see the Gaza, this little microcosm that you've so wonderfully pointed to here and are following, do you see this as kind of a broader metaphor for, say, the people like I spoke to a little bit earlier about, say, people in Hong Kong, which is, you know, obviously a very different conflict, or even in Venezuela? Do you you see any corollaries or connections there?
Definitely. So since I've been reporting in this space, it's been 2 years-ish now, I would say that I've interviewed a little bit over 80 what I would consider marginalized users. So that can be someone in Gaza, that can be someone in Iran, that can be someone in the Hong Kong protests, people that are using Bitcoin actually for its censorship resistance purposes. And across that spectrum, you see that depending on the situation, people have very different needs. They use it maybe in different ways. But overall, there's always connecting themes. I definitely think that what's happening in Gaza in terms of people turning to Bitcoin as a tool because the other tools are inaccessible to them is generally when it is that people turn to Bitcoin for this kind of usage, for not speculation or storage, but for transacting when other transactions won't go through, and also in some ways for savings when savings are hard to come by and keep safe. Although I will say that unlike areas like Iran or Turkey, I did not meet many Gazans that were saving in Bitcoin, but that's mostly because of the poverty level. Like they don't have a lot to save. When they're accessing Bitcoin, they're doing it because they need to get food, shelter, and tuition, like these kinds of very basic needs. But across the board, I do see that when we have governments cracking down on something, or when we see, like in the Hamas case, governments buying into something, really using something, something paying attention to something, we see the population also take note of that. So we saw a very similar trend in Iran, where when the government started more tightly regulating Bitcoin usage within the country, a lot of people that weren't previously in the Bitcoin community were, oh, if the government wants to regulate this, that means it might be valuable. Let me take a look at that.
Yeah,
so
mining.
We're seeing a Streisand effect with Bitcoin.
Yes, yes, no, that's a brilliant point. And I remember in Iran when the, I guess it was the finance minister came out with he just started talking about how they have to better regulate mining and electricity. I thought, whoa, he's presuming that Bitcoin's already, you know, there, it's baked in, which I found super, super fascinating. So excellent point again. So I lied. One last question. Do you see or did you find any other cryptos being used? I'm assuming they're using BTC because, you know, depending on the tech sophistication and knowledge of our very incestuous kind of myopic world here in crypto, that maybe outside of Bitcoin there isn't a whole lot more knowledge. But am I wrong, or were they using other cryptos as well?
There's an increasing interest in Ethereum, which was surprising for me. There's a lot of people, a lot of people think that the poverty in Gaza and also in the West Bank also has a severe poverty issue, has to do with a lack of education, and this is not the case. Actually, Palestinians are highly educated. They just don't have access to kind of white-collar jobs that would help raise them out of the economic situation they're in. So for freelance developers who are looking for online work, the Ethereum community actually has a lot to offer. So there's a lot of interest in learning how to contribute to Ethereum projects, hoping that they'll be able to be hired by startups abroad. There's also small amounts of interest in Zcash, but I would not say that was in any way something I could measure. It was more something offhand. And I'd be very interested to see, as the various cryptos grow, which one of them starts to take hold as the secondary to Bitcoin in Palestine as a region. Because right now, I mean, Bitcoin dominance is pretty strong, pretty universal. People turn to Ethereum for job opportunities, and sometimes they're maybe interested in figuring out stuff about Zcash, but I wouldn't say that there's any liquidity on the ground for that at the moment.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And I think shifting towards privacy coins as we move on, those that work in those areas are going to be increasingly important. So I have kept you way beyond the time that I asked for. So I super appreciate that. It is Lee Quen, LEIGHCUEN of CoinDesk. Get out there. We'll have links in the show notes pages to her work and her author's page. She is mandatory reading in the space, always has something great to say. She does a lot of background work, and as you can hear, she knows her stuff. So thank you so much for coming on. We really, really appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care.